The collapse of the reserve price scheme set up in the early 70s was immense. In fact, my next guest, Charles Massey, says it was the most costly failure of any commodity program in history. And for its time, in fact, for almost all time, Australia's largest financial disaster. And he reckons it was caused by hubris and anti-competitive spirit, which had been deeply entrenched in the Australian economy for decades, by good old-fashioned agrarian socialism. And Charles has pretty good credentials here. He has had a 36-year involvement in the wool industry. He founded the leading merino stud, Severn Park, in 1975, and he's long been regarded as one of the wool industry's thinkers and innovators. He visited the farm recently, showed me his book, had to get him on. The book, Breaking the Sheep's Back, the shocking true story of the decline and fall of the Australian wool industry. Welcome to our studio, Charles.
Evening, Philip. Thanks very much.
You tried to sort of do a bit of whistleblowing on this story way back when, didn't you? Because you were commissioned to write a series of articles for the Australian Farm Journal and suddenly copped a fatwa from the heavies in the wool industry.
That's right. It was an intriguing experience. I'd had a couple of years on statutory boards. I was appointed by Simon Crean after yet another wool disaster after the big collapse. But the fact that I was the first wool grower since their inception in the 30s that hadn't come out of politics, I had some good targets on my back, so I didn't last long. And then I was asked to do these articles by the editor of Farm Journal, and all hell broke loose after I was sort of halfway in, and injunctions, late-night phone calls, threatening to lose the farm, the minister's office ringing. And I walked away and said to myself, what the hell was all that about?
But you've walked back now, haven't you? And your book is almost like the Royal Commission we never had.
Well, it is. It's a, if you like, a private Royal Commission because, as you said in the introductions, this is Australia's biggest business disaster, the world's biggest buffer stock scheme collapse, and the government's fingerprints are all over this. And in fact,
and it reduced globally the wool. The wool industry around the world was in peril, wasn't it?
Well, it was. You see, Australia was we had about 80% of the world's apparel wool, which makes us the sort of queen bee. If we sort of have a sniffle, the world gets the flu. And so when it goes awry, the world tumbles. And it was our customers who were hunted away by this sort of crass stupidity at the statutory level.
Charles, what we're talking about is the old Australian fault line between free trade and protectionism, isn't it?
It is, Philip. It goes back to our very inception at Federation, where we sort of chose the middle path between laissez-faire American free capitalism and the reverse. And McEwen, this rot with the reserve price scheme actually started in the Menzies government from 1950 under Blackjack McEwen. And they didn't know when to get off the protectionist wagon, and that's where things came unstuck.
But there was a big divide within the rural sector, wasn't there? Because the larger landholders, who went back to the days of the squatters, tended to be a bit more free trade, and the smaller operators wanted protection.
They did, and if you bear in mind that McEwen had been a soldier settler, and a lot of the key players came through those harsh 1920s and 30s. And I remember reading a biography of McEwen. He once helped a neighbour who was so poor. They had to bury the neighbour's six-year-old child at night because he didn't have the money to pay for a burial. Now, you're going to be scarred by that. And a lot of the soldier settlers, which was a major, a monumental policy disaster, they were scarred, and so they felt the government owed them a living, and they tended to be the smaller wool growers.
So there was a class distinction ingredient, and the Country Party, of course, agrarian socialist par excellence. So there's all sorts of things happening. But you also point out, and I'd forgotten this, that the wool industry was imbued with British imperial dependent attitudes. Talk to that.
Absolutely. It began in the First World War when the Australian government handed over all Australia's key commodities. They were regarded as strategic war resources. Wool,
you mean we ceded the national wool clip to the British?
Yep. Here you are, Britain. Take this. Which, of course, by the end of the war, the price was pegged. Wool growers were getting less than cost of production. British manufacturers made mega profits, but at the same time, Britain blocked its major competitors like America from getting access to this wool. And then, lo and behold, Second World War, our Anglophile Prime Minister Menzies and London High Commissioner Stanley Melbourne Bruce, an arch Anglophile, they ceded the wool clip again.
The book's full of things which are really fascinating. You say the Menzies government was responsible for a largely unknown decision way back in 1950 to refuse an offer by the Americans to buy the wool clip during the Korean War, once again preferring to turn to the mother country. I mean, this is a remarkable colonial cringe.
It is, and Canberra historian Les White actually called it self-imposed colonialism, and that story you've alluded to was in secret cabinet documents I dug up. America got sick of being blocked out from access to the best wool for two wars, and when the Korean War bobbed up, they made a secret approach in August 1950 to the Menzies government at the highest level, requesting that they be allowed to control the acquisition of the clip. And Australia turned its back on America in favour of the mother country and a reserve price scheme.
Well, explain in simple terms to the Gladys and the Poddies and this ageing presenter, who doesn't have many sheep on his farm, what this reserve price system was and how it worked while it worked, until it didn't work catastrophically later on.
It was a common feature from the early 20th century that there was a belief amongst governments worldwide that you could control the fluctuating prices of commodities, and it was tried in rubber, tin, cocoa. They were called buffer stock schemes, and the idea is...
They were called what schemes?
Buffer stock.
Buffer stock, right.
So you set what's called a minimum or floor price. If the price goes below, the government or its authority buys in and then sells into the market. The big floor, Philip, is... And that's why there's been
a big floor on the floor.
To use a bad pun, is that there's 100% failure rates with these, and the best brains were telling the Menzies government right through, and I'm talking about Sir Rowland Wilson and Richard Randall, heads of Treasury, don't go here. This is 100% failure rate because every single scheme fell over for one reason, and that was human nature steps in, and when you get a boom price, price is raised too high.
Well, you've talked about Blackjack McEwen. Let's introduce another character who had, during his era, the most famous haircut in Australia, the head of the wool board, Sir William Gunn. It was a Dagwood Bumstead haircut, wasn't it, with a part down the middle. And it was as much an icon during his era as Uluru.
Well, it was. It's almost like an echidna had buried itself in his head with a part down the centre. But on top of that was this outrageous larrikin of a bush character.
Charismatic, wasn't he?
Well, I think he's possibly the largest character ever bestride an Australian political stage. He was 6'5", 18 stone. In the old terms, his clothes hung off him like a potato sack, etc. So, outrageous at the time, but he could woo a wool grower with sweet talk, even if he was talking nonsense.
And did.
And successfully, what happened was that Menzies government tried in 1951 to railroad in a scheme. 100,000 wool growers said no. They said no again in 1965. So McEwen, bearing in mind that Bill Gunn was McEwen's best mate, in fact, McEwen wanted him to become his replacement leader at one stage, and he lost pre-selection for Maranoa over it. But they, having lost two referenda, said, well, to hell, we'll bring this in undercover.
I remember the high point of the boom before the bust and that multi-million-dollar bash to celebrate the wool industry held at the Opera House, attended by Charles and Di, and as you say, it symbolised the delusion and hubris of the wool industry leadership. They couldn't fail.
No, they couldn't, and I guess it was a booming market. I think that's you've honed in on the key thing, Philip. Here's the staid old wool industry that had been the backbone of Australia for 150 years. Surely they wouldn't get caught up in the 1980s craziness of the corporate cowboys. But in fact, they did, and that sort of symbolises the peak of that hubris.
There was also, of course, some pretty classy marketing going on. I think it has to be said that the Wool Board's international marketing advertising campaign was cutting edge. It was widely admired.
It was, but if you look at the analysis from top economists, the market pretty well followed the commodity cycle up and down. So,
despite that effort?
Well, undoubtedly it worked at the margin, but in reality, a lot of that marketing was directed at the wool growers who are paying compulsory taxes. And at the end of this scheme, before it fell over, Australian wool growers were paying compulsory taxes of $250 million for the marketing. And when this whole thing started to come unstuck, when sort of $5 billion went in the blink of less than 18 months, the wool growers were actually paying at one stage, to pay for the folly of their leaders, 25% of their gross income up front. That's not after expenses or anything.
And yet, the likes of Kerry Packer, Rupert Murdoch, Alan Bond, Robert Holmes of Court, John Elliott were swept up in the excitement.
Well, that's right. I mean, the wool market was booming. Anyone could make money out of sheep. Wheat was languishing. So all the bees were attracted to the honeypot because it seemed like it would go on forever. And that sort of attitude came into the board decisions.
You particularly focus on John Elliott pushing the Wool Corp to set the floor price as high as possible and disparaging the Japanese buyers. In fact, customer bashing was a feature of the whole saga.
Yeah, that's the sad thing, Philip, and that came back from the earlier story you're telling about the small wheat sheep farmers. They had this antipathy going way back that the middleman customer was always ripping them off, the wheat trader and the wool trader. And that came right through into the agri-politicians who were really running the show, dictating almost to the Wool Corporation at the end, that there was this antipathy. And when I went overseas speaking to the world's leading managing directors of these companies, they virtually said, you are the first Australian to start our story. And when it all fell over, these customers, a lot of family companies in Italy lost from $8 to $14 million overnight. One company lost $30 million. And they were still being treated like dirt, as if they were the enemy.
ABC Radio National Late Night Live. My guest is wool grower Charles Massey, who's the author of Breaking the Sheep's Back, the shocking true story of the decline and fall of the Australian wool industry. Let's now look at the moment when it happened, February 1991.
Yes, well, what happened was they set the Wool Corporation Board, despite cautionary advice to the contrary, set a price at 870 cents in June 1988, way above the long-term market, but certainly below the boom market. By late 1989, the world commodity prices turned down with a slowing in the global economy. And suddenly, in the blink of an eye, to defend a price they refused to lower, from about August to the end of 1989, they'd not only blown $1.8 billion in kitty from selling a previous stockpile, but they'd borrowed another $2 billion. And they then proceeded to borrow...
That's $2 billion then.
Exactly right.
So it's a lot more in current money terms.
Absolutely, which I've calculated through, as you said in the first introduction. A conservative calculation when it all fell over is about $12 billion, which is over $20 billion in today's terms. So, you know, Bondi and the boys looked like playing tiddlywinks in this class.
And, of course, it happened on Labor's watch, didn't it? Someone I really liked, John Kerin, was Primary Industries Minister, and you talk about one Italian cloth producer saying, who still says John Kerin should be hanged in Martin Place. It wasn't John's fault, but he didn't respond to the crisis well?
Yeah, well, look, as you know from writing, sometimes you've got to tell the truth, and it's hard because I interviewed John. I have a lot of respect for him. He's a decent fellow, a lot of integrity. He was jammed. Yes, he could have acted more decisively and not prevaricated. But there's a couple of things. Economists call it moral hazard.
Yeah.
He was advised coming into the March 1990 election not to talk about wool because it would have been politically disastrous. So they hung off at the very moment that they should have acted, and they had clauses in the Act to withhold funds. And then after that, when it started to go wrong, the Wool Corporation, and particularly the agricultural politicians, blamed Kerin viciously for what was, in effect, their intransigence. And he, I think, was hanging off, hoping they would see sense because he didn't want to cause World War III. But in the end, it dragged on too long until the government said, you know, no more money.
Elmswood, which you visited, was a very famous Merino property in the 30s. We pulled out of wool, more by happy accident than anything. But at the time, there's an $8.70 floor price. So farmers are pumping the bloody stuff out. The stockpile reaches that immense figure of 4.7 million bales, but much of it was of inferior quality. Why was that?
Well, that's the hidden costs here. The model set up by Bill Gunn and the guy on his right shoulder behind him, a bloke called Sir William Vines, had worked for in London for one of the synthetic companies. Their model was to create this giant DuPont. I call it a Willy DuPont, which is a quasi-socialist body. To do that, you have to get rid of individuality and innovation with individuals' fibres and try and get this sort of mediocrity, bland thing. And that's that led to, because of the market signals, volumes of mediocre or crap wool being bred because you just got paid for whatever was coming, and that's what was left in the stockpile.
The other thing was, and I'd forgotten this, but this crisis occurs right at the time when the Hawke heating tussle is at its most intense. So no one wants to focus on piles of wool.
No, I had a fascinating interview with Paul Keating, and so they, as I said before, they hung off talking about wool until the election was over, and of course there was the Kirribilli Agreement between Hawke and Keating, which Keating told me, and Paul Kelly and others have written about. Hawke started to renege pretty soon after the agreement. And Keating claimed, and I had it verified by some of his staff, that to retain the premiership, he needed some support in cabinet, key support. One of them was Beazley, which allowed compromise on the telecommunications. And the other one was Cairn, which meant compromising on wool. And Keating's words were, wool was a sacrificial lamb for Bob to retain the premiership. But, you know, you have to read a bit more into that. As you know, politicians can often push their barrow a bit.
The damage to the wool industry has been permanent, hasn't it? But it, because of, among other things, there's been a switch to other fibres, including synthetics.
Yes, well, this destruction of capital amongst our customers, a lot of them started to withdraw before it even fell over. They moved their capital elsewhere, they substituted into other fibres, then they went broke or lost further. A good measure, Philip, of how we'd gone into the political and economic doldrums through this myopic policy was that in the sort of 15 years after it all fell over, global demand for textiles went up 40%. Wool's performance dropped by 50%.
Charles, any relevance to this discussion, between this discussion and the mining boom? Lessons to be learned?
Great lessons. I think the other big story out of this book is the cautionary tale aspect. Human nature, every generation we get caught up in the next boom cycle and we think it'll last forever. We're seeing it again now. We think the global financial crisis won't come. And you could extend that to a refusal to listen to some of the Cassandras presently talking about the coming climate change and we're running out of key resources and those sorts of things. So I think there is a larger cautionary tale here, as you're alluding to.
Well, we didn't have the Royal Commission, but we've got the book. Good on you, Charles. Charles Massey's Breaking the Sheep's Back, the shocking true story of the decline and fall of the Australian wool industry. And as you read it, you think, well, this is much bigger scandal than, say, the Australian Wheat Board.
Well, it's extraordinary. It hasn't been told. And the interesting thing, Philip, is the same flawed policy, which is still in existence in the wool industry, applied to the Wheat Board and also applies the other day to the MLA debacle in the Indonesian beef slaughtering.
Charles, thanks for your time. The book is published by the University of Queensland Press. Late Night Live, a little bit of music, and we're going to chat about Simone de Beauvoir. There's a change of everything.